Carl, our guest for this particular segment is Brian Kenneth Swain. He's an engineer, a business person whose professional career has spanned 23 years and more, having worked for Bell Laboratories and other companies. He's a poet, an author. But the topic for our discussion today is, are Americans questioning their religious roots? And Mr. Swain suggests that perhaps the old traditions for youngsters, they're just not accepting what their parents used to believe or said or do. So, Mr. Swain, thank you so much for joining us on Smith Sabatino.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
How did you come up with this idea to do that kind of research?
I would preface all of this by saying I'm not a religious person. However, the topic of religion has always intrigued me enormously, you know. And I look at this and I say, what is it about the story, the narrative, that something like 95% of the world's population find compelling in one version or another? You know, and there must be really something very substantive to this that make all of those billions of people believe whatever it is they believe. So that's what causes me to read about it a great deal and to follow events in the news and to dig down in and to try to understand just you know, what it is that that people get out of spirituality or religion or whatever word you care to apply.
Are you an individual who was born and raised into some kind of specific discipline, but then rejected that to find something different?
That's a pretty accurate description. I grew up in New England in a Baptist church, and did that for till probably early teens. And I got to a point in life, like a lot of people, where I started asking a lot of questions. And then after spending time in the service and spending time in college in New York and doing various things, essentially came to my own, for lack of a better term, belief system that does not happen to include things like deities and miracles and all of those things.
And dogma, I would imagine. Yeah.
There's a fair bit of that as well, but it does depend, you know, from one faith to the next, the degree of flexibility and objectivity in these things varies, I expect.
I read a phrase once that kind of resonated with me, and I throw it out every once in a while in discussion with friends and colleagues, and it does cause a little bit of a debate. But here it is. To be born in a religion is wonderful. To die in it is unfortunate.
Yeah, and you know, one of the words that I use when I talk with people about religion that upsets many of them is the fact that it's really quite arbitrary. And it's arbitrary in the sense that for the great majority of adherents to whatever your faith may be, you are part of that faith and that tradition essentially because you were born into it. It's what your parents knew and it's what their parents knew. And with very few exceptions, it's what you you know, carry throughout your life, and frankly, probably pass on to your children as well. So, to me, that feels quite arbitrary, especially when you start talking about who is it that's really in possession of the truth, with quotes around that.
Mrs. Swan, Carl Sabatino here. The question I have, and I was listening intently to you and Roland as you began this interview, for those that have that kind of belief, that continue to believe in the dogma. Do you see any difference? Do you see a sense of proportionally difference between your beliefs and theirs, except that they have a encased in a dogma as opposed to the fact that you do not?
Well, I mean, there are plenty of people, and probably including most religious people, who would argue quite plausibly that a lack of religion or a lack of faith, whether you call that atheism or agnosticism, is in fact a dogma in itself, right? You know, we like to wrap ourselves in words like science and reason and rationality and naturalism and those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, no matter what your belief system is, everybody believes in something, right? So in a case like mine and many other people, you know, that something leans more toward those words like science and so forth. But it's It's still at the end of the day a belief system, and frankly, for a lot of people in this camp, it can rise to the level of dogma if they become really very zealous about their lack of religion, if you like.
But my point is, and I get your point. My point is, though, you're good people. That you are honest people, that you are, whether you have a dogma, you don't have a dogma. Do you see this as a step forward in terms of life? That if someone believes in God or not, but they are good people, they contribute, they're charitable, they give back to their fellow men, et cetera, and so forth, and or live their life as they see fit, not hurting anyone else, and so on. That there is a dogma, having one or not having one, does that make a difference? Which is my point.
I don't know that it makes a difference. I think the broader question that you're alluding to is this notion of, is religion or is faith required in order to have morality? And I would argue certainly not, and a lot of other people would as well. But it's we have our own belief systems, whether you subscribe to the view that they're innate or that we get them from our parents or the society that we grow up in. I don't happen to believe that you need a religious underpinning in order to be the sort of moral contributing type of individual that you're describing.
Was poetry that you do, I know you're a poet, was poetry, what would you call it, a catalyst for you to scrutinize your own religion?
I think it is. I've been writing poetry longer than I have been writing fiction and nonfiction, and I try to even when I'm writing in prose, I try to employ as many poetic sort of techniques as I can in the course of the writing. But a lot of the themes that poets return to again and again, you know, life and death and faith and all of those things, most definitely cause you to step back and try to look objectively at the way you live your own life and the way others live theirs. So yeah, I think it's a very reflective way to spend one's time, and it's also a way because of the nature of poetry and the language that's used, it forces you to compress whatever it is you believe in those regards into a fairly compact type of form that you don't tend to do as much of when you're writing prose. So it makes you think about it in a somewhat more rigorous way, I think.
Do you think that religions ought to encourage all participants to question their belief system?
I absolutely do. However, if you ask me how many religions actually do that, I would suggest to you not very many, some more than others. One of the reasons that I got away from the tradition that I grew up in was for precisely that reason, because once it rose to the point where I was asking the difficult questions, the response that folks fell back on was the idea that there was something inherently wrong with questioning these things, and that you know, you should use your heart and not your head, and you should basically accept these things simply because they are, you know, handed down in a holy book and that sort of thing. And I found that I couldn't subscribe to that. And at the same time, a lot of the things that you are sort of obliged to accept, the narratives that you're obliged to accept, regardless of what faith you're a member of, it's sort of frowned upon, if you like, to start questioning those things. And
well, the fact that we are a global society these days compared to, let's say, 50, 60, 70 years ago, more people are exposed to other people's belief systems, and that may in fact itself cause you to question your own.
Oh, you bet. I mean, the first thing that, you know, if you're like me and you grow up in a fairly insular, northeastern part of the U.S., and the first time you meet anybody who's not like you is when you go to school in New York City, and suddenly you're surrounded by people of different races and colors and creeds and beliefs and so forth. It's a fairly jarring thing, but in a good way. You know, between that and time in the military, you suddenly discover that the world is populated by lots and lots of different people, and one of the things that I hope happens when people read books like the one that I've written here is that it will cause them to look at what they believe with something like objectivity. And that's a difficult thing for a lot of people to wrap their heads around, because once you start stepping back and saying, do I believe in this narrative and this set of miracles and this set of accounts of, you know, how the earth and the universe came to be and all of that, it becomes a more challenging thing to defend, even if only for yourself. If the only reason you believe something is because it's written down in a 2,000-year-old book, or because someone in a position of authority in a church tells you that you should believe it, to me that doesn't really pass the sniff test of plausibility.
I'm with you. And on that note, then, I want to thank you, Brian Kenneth Swain, very much for joining us on Smith Sabatino, and look forward to talking to you again, or you should come back and visit us once again.
I look forward to it as well. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Carl Sabatino, Roland Smith. Interesting topic. We're back.
Welcome to American Biker Minute. SNS Tech says running E85 can melt a V-twin engine.
I've had guys, some of these gas stations kind of play tricks on people a little bit, or they don't realize what they're getting, but it says high octane fuel, and it'll be E85.
You said?
Well, you're about to melt your motor down.
Today on American Biker Minute.
Do you have troubled skin or acne? With Proactive Plus, your acne can heal, and you can help prevent new breakouts from happening. Call Proactive Plus now and receive a 60-day risk-free trial along with 2 free extras and free shipping. Call 800-393-6139. That's 1-800-393-6139.
Jeff Ryan for American Biker Minute. Tech says, don't believe every gas station sign.
It says high octane fuel, and it'll be E85. And they'll put that stuff in their bike and run it. And they'll run, and these newer bikes with oxygen sensors on it will actually run pretty good, and they adjust as far as they can. But, man, I've had them come into the shop. I'm getting these great mileage, but the thing's kind of pinging. It's like, well, you're about to melt your motor down, you know?
American Biker Minute.
Recalibrate if you're going to do that kind of stuff.
Your passport to the open road on two wheels.
Where are they now with Ahmad Rashad?
For 13 seasons, this small Ford was known as much for his trash-talking as for his shooting. He was so deadly from three-point range, it earned him the nickname the Rifleman.
He'll pull up and shoot a three. Watch it. There it goes. That'll be good. It is the Person Show.
So where is Chuck Person now? Chuck retired and watched his younger brother, Wesley Person, become a three-point threat in his own right. Chuck has spent more than 10 years as an assistant coach with the Kings, Cavs, and Pacers, and in 2011, he joined the L.A. Lakers. Funny seeing such an offensive player become a great defensive coach.
And the one thing about scores that go to the other side of the ball is they know what to take away from the offensive players.
Nice to see the Rifleman still on target. I'm Ahmad Rashad.
The Movie Man 6-second review starts now.
For kids, these fun, zany, banana-colored characters are far from despicable. They're one in a minion. The Minion.
6-second reviews are brought to you by Marvel's Ant-Man. Now playing.